You're listening to the Americans for Truth Hour with your host, Peter LaBarbera. Each week, you'll hear compelling interviews with everyday heroes on the front lines of the culture war. People who put faith and truth above the lies of political correctness. Americans for Truth Hour will help you to stay informed and engaged on the side of life, marriage, and the God-ordained family. Please stand with us as we work to make America, in the words of President Ronald Reagan, a shining city on the hill. And once again, one nation under God. And now, here's Peter LaBarbera.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Americans for Truth Hour. Americans for Truth is a single-issue organization devoted to opposing and exposing the powerful homosexual activist movement. I'm here at John Kirkwood's church, Pastor John Kirkwood, Grace Gospel Fellowship. The website is gracebeliever.com. John, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
Yeah, John is a unique kind of pastor that just if you're in the Chicago area, come to Grace Gospel Fellowship. He's an amazing guy, and we're happy to have him being involved with this Americans for Truth on this crucial issue. And we're also very delighted to welcome back Professor Rena Lindewaldson. Rena, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Thank you.
This time I'm a little more organized, and I actually brought your bio, which is very impressive, by the way.
It is, Rena. For Pete, it's very impressive.
Yeah, well, you know, compared to my bio.
Rena, it took him about 5 weeks to get the name of my church right. But
yeah, I feel like a peon reading your, you know, reading your bio. But anyways, make sure I've got this right. You are a professor of law at an associate director of the Liberty Center for Law and Policy. But you're a law professor at the Liberty University School of Law, correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So you teach law at Liberty University. It's getting rave reviews across the country. One of our board of directors from Americans for Truth, Matt Barber, also teaches there, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And, you know, he's such a shy and unassuming guy.
And there are only two colleges in the whole country I recommend. And Liberty's one of them. Liberty and Hillsdale.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and how many classes do you teach a semester?
Two classes a semester.
And what's the name of one of them?
One of them is Foundations of Law, which is it's a course we offer a first year to make sure students get a proper grounding in the biblical foundations of American history.
Wow. I can imagine that's a far cry from what they might learn at Harvard Law School.
It's a far cry from what they're learning pretty much in all their undergrads and at law schools across the country, yes.
And so we want to have some time in this episode. We have lots of news to talk about, but we want to talk about, you know, spend a few minutes about your purpose, which is to return the law to a sort of a virtuous foundation, what it was intended to be, to preserve our liberties in this country. That's what you aim to do, correct?
Absolutely. And it's an uphill battle at this point, but we certainly have hope it can be accomplished, and obviously through a spiritual renewal in this country as well.
That's right. We need a revival. And John, Rena,
you know, I think that's the only way, Pete. If you've read Slouching Toward Gomorrah from Judge Bork, and if you've read Mark Levin's book on the men in the black robes, really the only hope for this country is a spiritual revival.
Well, yeah, and I was thinking today how it seems, you guys, that we're always maybe a decade or more behind really understanding where the culture is. We're behind. I mean, we don't realize, a lot of Christians aren't really coming to grips with how depraved our culture is. I mean, I hate to put it any other way, you know. And Rena, part of that has happened because our legal activists on the left have targeted, they want to bring down a traditional morality. And they're using the law to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're on a quicker trajectory than we might have been otherwise because we've got, you know, the activist organizations who are seeking to essentially put the immorality that exists, you know, in our human nature and have it made as valid law in this country. And they are using the judiciary to do that, which is moving us on a very fast pace. But I do agree, you know, we need that spiritual revival. We need education, what you do, and educating people about what's taking place, and then education on how do we go about changing this, stopping it, and helping to prevent us from moving in this direction.
Right. And Rena, we both know that homosexual activists have targeted the legal profession as a way to change culture.
Absolutely.
Yeah. In your opinion, Rena, when did they first figure out that the best way to bypass the will of the people was through the courts?
Well, I think you see a radical change. I mean, I think it's existed for a long time. You didn't always have the courts coming along with them. But tracing back to really the 40s, you start to see the use of the Supreme Court in particular to change the law. And in this case, is, you know, 1970s with Roe versus Wade and abortion. And then you had the change, you know, 1986, you know, homosexuality isn't a protected right. Well, 2003, it suddenly is a protected right. So we've been moving very quickly since the 1940s, certainly the 1970s with Roe versus Wade, and since then, the courts have regularly been used to change the law.
Right, and Rena, maybe we're doing this discussion now, John. Instead, we're going to move on to Chick-fil-A and all that's happening in the culture. But I mean, what? Explain. You're in it for the long term. You're educating young people because we've lost so many young people. And what is the difference of a young person, Christian or not? First of all, do you have to be a Christian to attend your school? I suppose not. But what is the difference between attending Liberty University School of Law and, say, the typical liberal law school?
Wow.
It's really easy for me to answer because I attended a typical liberal law school in New York City, and as did most of our professors, so we know what we were trained in. The difference is the idea that our legal system is premised on a biblical belief that there is a creator, and that creator gives us our inalienable rights, not the government. And so as we study the biblical foundations, there is an objective truth. Our founders knew that. What were those truths that they were trying to instill in our law? And to get people to understand that you can't just change those terms. Truth can't be relative. Liberty can't mean we're going to legalize immorality contrary to Scripture. When you do that, you change who we are as a nation, and we are set on the path that we see us going down right now. In every other law school, or most law schools across the country where I was trained, you're trained law is subjective. It's whoever's in charge, whoever can make the decision. There are no objective truths. There's no firm foundation. It's really might makes right. And you know, you become very cynical, and you realize that you can use the law, the legal profession, to change the law through the judiciary.
And it's all about the precedent. But it seems the precedents usually go against us. For example, like you mentioned, Bowers versus Hardwick, there was no right to sodomy. Lawrence v. Texas, there is a right. And, of course, that's evolving the right way. I don't think the left would tolerate it if it went the wrong way and we went back, you know, back towards tradition. It seems it's always going one way.
And that was a big part. You mentioned case law and case precedent of how we've seen the law change so quickly. You know, a system was developed coming from Ivy League schools and Langdell that we're not going to read the original source of the Constitution to figure out what the Constitution means. We're going to read the last opinion the Supreme Court issued on what the Constitution means in that 5-4 vote. And then we're going to read the last two decisions when we go to rule the next time. So you get further and further away from what it originally meant, and you have all these opinions of what the judges are with their moral beliefs infused in this. And that is how you see the progression and the change, that we just keep moving further and further and further away from what our founders intended. And now the Supreme Court and other courts come right out and say, it doesn't matter what our traditions were. It doesn't matter what we believed 150 years ago. What's relevant is 50 years ago. Well,
right.
50 years ago is drastically different than our founders intended us to be. And that's how they're changing the law.
But even 50 years ago, they're not content with that. I mean, 50 years ago, homosexuality was abhorrent to most people in the culture. It was pretty much taboo. They're certainly not, that's not evolved. And I always laugh, John, at the idea of evolution supporting homosexuality. I'm on Twitter a lot, and you can go to my page. It's just twitter.com/my name, Peter LaBarbera. And I got one of these nasty tweets. Oh, you just haven't evolved. You know,
well,
someday you'll evolve. Evolving towards a lifestyle that is non-procreative,
yeah.
Doesn't that sort of contradict evolution?
Yeah, they can make an argument from nature because you can see it randomly in nature. But you know, it's not simply homosexuality. It's just, you know, certain animals will do anything that moves. But they can't make the argument from evolution. Because Darwin's very definition of survival of the fittest really wasn't, you know, an octagon situation where the strength wins. The very definition of that was how much you procreate. And obviously, if you look at homosexuals, they don't procreate. So by definition, they would be selected by nature to fail.
Right.
So evolution is very harsh on the homosexual. And that's why I always, when I talk about this with people, I always say there's redemption in Christ, but in Darwin, there's nothing but extinction.
Well, the Declaration of Independence talks, Rena, about nature and nature's God. it seems we're evolving against God and certainly against nature as well when it comes to the homosexual issue.
Yeah, and that, you know, the Declaration of Independence, a lot of people just try to say it's irrelevant to understanding what our country's about, but it's, you know, it's the foundational principles that the founders used to then draft the Constitution, and when you understand that that protection of an unalienable right to liberty was given to us by a creator God, you have to interpret liberty to be consistent with that creator God. So you don't have a liberty to kill your unborn child. You don't have a liberty right to engage in sexual immorality, and yet that's what our Supreme Court is finding.
Well, go ahead.
Rena, John Adams, though, did say our Constitution that you speak of was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Are we getting to the stage where it's wholly inadequate?
We are, and that's where, you know, we try to talk with our students to get them to understand what that means. It was because the Constitution doesn't lay out, you know, do, don't. It's not all this list of do's and don'ts. It's because there was a moral framework that it was understood that everyone would operate within. And if we didn't have the moral restraint, our Constitution wasn't going to stop us. It wasn't meant to do that. And I think we are getting to that point, if we're not already there, that that moral restraint doesn't exist. And therefore, you see the chaos that we really are starting to see in our government.
Well, Rena, when the typical student comes to Liberty Law School, do they get to the point where there's like a flashbulb that goes off in their head and they say, oh, I'm starting to get it. It's not about do's and don'ts. It's that they have to unlearn some things and get back. I mean, imagine that there's a lot of students who don't have near an understanding of our history that they should.
It's one of the reasons I absolutely love this course when I see those moments happen.
Well, I think all of America needs to take Rena's course, John.
Yeah.
I think that's it would benefit them all. There's more to Rena Lindewald, and she's written a book about the Lisa Miller case, which is a very troubling case of a woman who doesn't want to lose her daughter because she left the lesbian lifestyle. But we'll be right back with Rena Lindewald. Our website is AmericansForTruth.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Americans for Truth Hour. I'm here with John Kirkwood, pastor of Grace Gospel Fellowship, and we're talking to Professor Rena Lindewaldson, who is a professor at the Liberty University School of Law. She's also associate dean for academic affairs there. Correct, Rena?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, I actually got it right. Okay, we're going to get to Chick-fil-A in a moment. Our esteemed mayor in Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, said that Chick-fil-A doesn't reflect Chicago values, John, and if anything ever that true was said by the mayor, of course they don't. Chick-fil-A is far superior. Their values are far superior to Chicago's values.
Well, apparently Chicago values now are inviting Louis Farrakhan and a 39% increase in violent crime.
Yeah, just the phrase Chicago values. What does that mean?
I don't know. 19 have been shot in the last couple days, so I'm not quite sure.
Over 100,000 people attend the Chicago Homosexual Pride celebrations every year. They've got their own sadomasochism museum.
Right? Well, you know, this is the same guy who just recently started to talk to us about gang values. You know,
yeah, you know,
use those gang values that you grew up with. You know,
but before we get to Chick-fil-A, because I don't want to lose it with Rena, you rarely get a chance to talk to somebody who's doing what Rena does, trying to restore biblical and virtuous values to the law. Rena, the number one thing you get hit with by gay activists on the left whenever somebody like you talks is, oh, don't these Christians know the separation of church and state? So talk about the misunderstandings that even a lot of believers, Christians and moral-minded people have, and how they're intimidated by this church and state argument thrown at them.
Sure. Two quick points. First of all, everyone needs to know separation of church and state isn't in the Constitution, and believe it or not, some don't realize that. What the First Amendment prohibits is the national government from establishing a national church. And you can look back in England and other countries to know just exactly what that was talking about. Over the years, the Supreme Court has twisted that, manipulated it, took its history, a phrase from Thomas Jefferson in a letter he wrote to Danbury Baptist, and he was just reminding the Danbury Baptists, who were in the minority at the time, that, you know, his government as a president of the country when he was newly elected wasn't going to be used to infringe their rights. He doesn't believe that the government should be dictating religious beliefs, and nobody does. So that's what the Establishment Clause was meant to do. No national church, you're free to worship according to dictates of your conscience. It's been contorted to essentially mean that nothing religious, or I should say nothing Christian, is allowed in the public sphere. And so that's sort of, and that, again, 1940s, 1960s in particular, the Supreme Court has adopted that phrase to mean complete separation of church and state. So if it's a Christian, Judeo-Christian belief, it can't be allowed by any governmental entity. And so we took prayers out of schools, and we, you know, can't sing religious songs, you can't draw paintings. Those are the kind of decisions we have. I talk to my students about that, though, is even if you believe that there should be a separation of church and state, it's based on an improper understanding of how that can work, because everyone brings to the table a religious set of beliefs. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as any neutral zone that's religious value free. And so what this really is every religious value is allowed to participate in the public square except for Christianity. And that, to me, doesn't sound like even their version of separation of church and state.
There's a lot of anti-Christian animus there, isn't there? Because why else would we see liberals embracing Muslim activists who actually want to bring some kind of Sharia law to the United States? I mean, you'd think they would be, if they really cared about keeping that separation of church and state, they'd be totally, you know, working against the Sharia movement. But instead, there many liberals are pro-Muslim.
Absolutely. I mean, we saw that in California more than once, where you actually have in the public schools, we're going to study various Muslim holidays and participate in ceremonies and other activities that related to various to the Muslim religion. That was okay, but if you wanted to do anything related to Christianity, well, that's not allowed. Even the idea of, you know, this secular, if things have to be secular, well, that's a religious belief that God can be taken out of your daily life.
Right.
You know, so that's a religious belief as well. Why is that allowed? Because that's what they're taught 8 hours a day in most schools across the country.
It used to be called secular humanism, and there was a whole conservative movement against that, but how come that never really took hold, the idea of secular humanism as a religion?
I think it's, well, the Supreme Court once in a footnote recognized that it was a religion, but it didn't never built on that, never went anywhere with that. And so I think it's, a lack of understanding of people that no one has no religious values. Every worldview is a religious belief, a religious set of beliefs. And if that's the case and everyone has one, you can't keep one off the table without being discriminatory towards that particular set of beliefs.
Right. Okay. Now let's turn to Chick-fil-A. It's incredible. I was thinking about this morning. The homosexual movement has gotten as far as it has by being willing to try to intimidate people, by being absolutely fanatical. And John, now we see the situation where this poor Chick-fil-A, which is one of the most interesting and noble corporations you've ever seen. I mean, they actually have programs to help their workers and young people embrace Christian compassionate values. And because the CEO of Chick-fil-A, which is, of course, a fast food chicken place that based in, I believe it's based in Georgia, because he publicly made clear that he opposes the idea of redefining marriage to accommodate homosexuality, Chick-fil-A was already being vilified, but now the vilification has, of course, ratcheted up.
Mm-hmm.
And they're targeting Chick-fil-A. Why don't you play the clip about Dan Cathy, CEO of Chick-fil-A.
This is a news story about how it all started.
For Newsy, I'm Candace Aviles. When it comes to accusations that his company only supports traditional marriage, Chick-fil-A's head honcho says the chicken chain is, quote, guilty as charged. The comment comes from COO Dan Cathy in a recent interview with the Baptist Press. He said, "We are very much supportive of the family, the biblical definition of the family unit. We are a family-owned business, a family-led business, and we are married to our first wives. We give God thanks for that." And according to the blog Good As You, that wasn't all Cathy had to say on the subject. Here's what the COO said earlier on the Ken Coleman radio show.
I pray God's mercy on our generation that has such a prideful, arrogant attitude to think that we would the audacity to try to redefine what marriage is all about.
Chick-fil-A has long been accused of having anti-gay policies. A writer for Philadelphia Magazine says Cathy's comments in recent interviews are a little different from stuff he used to say. In the past, Cathy denied that the restaurant chain had a beef with gay folks. A reporter for the LA Times points out, guess this explains the company's donations to anti-gay groups. A report from LGBT advocacy group Equality Matters concluded that Chick-fil-A donated more than $3 million between 2003 and 2009 to Christian groups that oppose homosexuality.
Okay, let's cut it off there. You could note the bias in the reporting. A beef with gay folks,
anti-gay groups.
Anti-gay. Look, you stand for traditional morality. The homosexual lobby casts it as everything's, they personalize everything. You're anti-gay. You're anti-gay people. They're the ones who oppose our right to defend traditional morality in the public square. But now they're vilifying Chick-fil-A because the CEO or COO, Dan Cathy, actually, you know, enunciated his beliefs. John, how many, and Rena, how many liberal-oriented companies like Starbucks are open about supporting so-called homosexual marriage? But if a Christian says the opposite, they get vilified.
Target is carrying now gay greeting cards. So this is a very different thing. They're not openly promoting this stance. This is the owner's view. And so they've taken it to a very different level where you have groups on the other side that do openly promote homosexuality.
But if they want to promote traditional marriage, even if they want to, for example, give money to traditional marriage amendments, that's their right. I mean, this is America. We used to be free. Rena, it seems that the other side is redefining liberty almost, either practically through hardcore political action or through the law. I mean, they really want, you have to believe when you see this sort of vilification of a company that just is defending traditional marriage, you have to believe ultimately they want to censor us.
I don't think you have to guess as to what they want to do. I mean, they've been very clear, actually, some of those in governmental leadership and in their writings, that is their goal. We may have the right to have our beliefs in the privacy of our home and our church, but when you come out into the public realm, you have to be neutral. You can't have your religious beliefs, and if you do, they're free to discriminate against you because tolerance and non-discrimination, as they define it, is more important than your personal religious beliefs. So they admit they're trying to silence us.
Well, Rena, I even think, I know you said we can have our views in the home and in the church. I even think those are on the agenda. I mean, they'll get the public square, and then they won't stop. They'll go after our views in the home and in the church.
Well, and as I said, I immediately thought of a case coming out of somewhere in the West, I want to say California or Arizona, where the government already is going after home-based Bible studies. Mm-hmm. You know, the group got too big. It had 12 people in it once a week. And you know, so under zoning restrictions, they were cited and fined.
Also, Rena, I remember in Illinois when we were fighting the sexual orientation law, the pro-homosexuality law, the ACLU came in. And their definition of religious liberty was, hey, you can't force a church to hire a gay pastor, a homosexual pastor. But when it comes to, like, you know, the staff that's not doing pastoral duties, they would be affected under the non-discrimination law. So in other words, if the janitor comes in and says, hey, pastor, I'm coming out of the closet. Or if he says, hey, I want to be a woman from now on, I'm going to live as a woman. The ACLU argument, as I understand it, is that would be covered under the non-discrimination laws. So even the church's own property, the own governing of itself, of the church or a Christian school, would be affected by the anti-discrimination laws.
Yeah, and in fact, just yesterday I listened to a conference among legal scholars on this issue, and even though we had the Supreme Court case decide in this last year, dealing with what's called a ministerial exception, you know, that you can't, you are allowed to fire your pastor, for example, you know, and it goes a little bit broader than that. There's still no clear definition of how far that goes. So is the janitor covered? Is the secretary covered? And, you know, the people I was listening to yesterday were suggesting, well, you know, that's not important to the mission of that religious organization.
Right.
So, of course, they're subject to non-discrimination, even if they're living a life completely inconsistent with the biblical standards of the church.
And, Rena, just as there are mayors in Boston and Chicago saying Chick-fil-A is not welcome, there is now a politician in Florida trying to get rid of a church that meets in a school because of their stance on homosexuality.
Yeah, the liberals are always being aggressive, and it seems we're always on defense. We're talking to Professor Rena Lindevaldson, who is a professor at the Liberty University School of Law. I'm Pete LaBarber with Americans for Truth. Our website is americansfortruth.org. We'll be right back.
Are you sick and tired of homosexuality and gay marriage being celebrated by the liberal media and popular culture? Do you worry about the radical gay agenda being pushed on young children in schools? Are you worried that the gay movement will destroy America's religious freedoms? And are you offended that Christians are called bigots and homophobes just because they agree with God that homosexual behavior is wrong? Americans for Truth About Homosexuality is a single-issue group devoted to exposing and fighting the gay agenda. They are not about hate, but love for God's truth. They are Christians, so instead of celebrating homosexuality, they lift up the many ex-gays who have left it behind and now lead godly lives through Christ. But Americans for Truth needs your help. The gay lobby has lots of money, power, and media support, but it lacks truth. Please help keep this show on the air and educate America about the dangerous goals of this anti-Christian movement. Make your gift online today at AmericansForTruth.com. That's AmericansForTruth.com.
We're back with Professor Rena Lindewaldson of the Liberty University School of Law. I'm Pete LaBarbera here with John Kirkwood. Rena, we're talking about the conflict between a legal system that was set up to operate in a system where virtue is rewarded. Virtue of a virtuous country has liberty versus now a situation where groups on the left, activists, be they abortion activists, pornography activists, promiscuity activists, homosexual activists, they're now essentially using the law to promote vice. When you boil it down, is that safe to say? Okay, short answer from Rena Lindewaldson.
Absolutely. There's nothing more to say.
Okay, I'm thinking about the case in New Mexico of the Christian photographer who was sued because she refused to do, for her religious reasons, for being a Christian, she did not want to use her photographic skills to take pictures at a lesbian commitment ceremony. She was sort of set up. I believe she was fined, what, about $6,000, Rena?
Yeah, between that and 7,000.
Mm-hmm. She was sued under the New Mexico sexual orientation law. So that was an anti-discrimination law. As we've said before, John, when the legislators of New Mexico were passing a sexual orientation non-discrimination law, I guarantee they weren't talking about forcing Christians to take pictures at lesbian commitment ceremonies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you're seeing that with bed and breakfast. You're seeing it at bakeries, even. A bakery in Indiana.
Yeah.
It's popping up all over.
Anybody who deals with the whole gay wedding business is being affected. And just, Rena, I'm sure when the New Jersey legislature passed a sexual orientation law, nobody was talking about, hey, we're going to use this law to go after the Boy Scouts. So,
in fact, it's usually the opposite, because in order to get it passed, they have to show that they don't intend to harm religious organizations. So they usually get statements exactly the opposite made.
Right. Okay, so now we have, I'm noticing that homosexual activists like Wayne Besson, Truth Wins Out, a radical homosexual group, they're saying, for example, in this New Mexico case, hey, if a business person is engaged in the stream of commerce, to deny doing business with a homosexual is the same as denying doing business with a black person. And even though we would completely reject that analogy, that's what they're using, and that's how they're going to go forward. And that is how it seems to me, if courts uphold that, there goes our freedom. Mm. Is that going to, do you think that argument will work in the law arena?
Well, there's two issues there. One is, it's the Commerce Clause, which we all thought was going to, you know, have some radical change, perhaps with the healthcare case. You know, how broad is that Commerce Clause? Does it really reach a photographer who's operating in a, you know, in New Mexico somewhere, you know, who's not necessarily going and flying all across the country to do weddings and other ceremonies? She's a local photographer. Does it reach her? So how broad is the Commerce Clause? Because if it reaches every little local photographer, we're in trouble, because then government reaches everything in our lives. And then the second issue is this comparison that we always hear, comparing it to race. And, you know, we have laws protecting based on race. We know that that's improper discrimination. You know, right from the Declaration of Independence, we know that that's discrimination. It was incorrect. To raise to the level of immutable characteristics of race, that of sexual immoral conduct, you know, is something I hope the courts won't buy into, but I think we're going to see some courts doing it.
Right, and you were saying last time that the courts are using all sorts of newfangled arguments. It's sort of like their end is we have to promote gay rights. They'll use whatever means it takes. How can we rely on the courts? And now, I mean, I'm afraid even with the Supreme Court. I mean, are you hopeful that the Supreme Court would reject such an argument?
Hopeful always. Realistically, I have concerns. You know, given the judges on the bench, not sure which way that would go. You know, and having convinced them that that's not their role, well, they've played that role for so long now. They've already bought into the idea in Lawrence that, you know, if it's based on sexual orientation, then the only reason you pass a law against that is because you must hate homosexuals. And so we've seen that in two different Supreme Court cases now. So I would be concerned if they got another case dealing with sexual orientation and what they would require us to prove as to why we passed that law.
to reinforce your fear, Peter, about being it compared to race, Ryan Sorba had a great quote from Mark Stein in his upcoming book, The Born Gay Hoax. He says, historically, Stein explains moral concern for sexual activity between two persons of the same gender was identified as sodomy, an act. One can either think of sodomy as acceptable or unacceptable. Either way, it is an act that someone chooses. Then Stein explains that in the late 19th century, the act was redescribed as a condition of certain persons, and it was termed homosexuality. Next, only a few decades ago, homosexuality was upgraded again, this time referring to a person's very identity, so that now we identify people as being gay or straight or somewhere in between. And now here's the crux. Now the term describes who a person is. It has become as fundamental to one's identity as race. Each formulation raises the stakes. One can object to and even criminalize an act. One is obligated to be sympathetic towards a condition. But once it's a full-fledged 24/7 identity, like being Hispanic or Inuit, anything less than wholehearted acceptance gets you marked down as a bigot.
Yeah. Wow. And yet, Rena, you've written a book called Only One Mommy, dealing with a person who had that so-called identity, Lisa Miller, and God got a hold of her, and she left it behind. So obviously, it's a bogus comparison.
Yeah, well, even there, the homosexual activists always, when they talk about people who, you know, have this change in their lives, through the saving power of Jesus Christ, for the most part, you see these changes taking place, the first thing you're going to say is they're lying to themselves. They're telling the person that you didn't really change because they can't allow these people to exist. They can't allow for the idea that you can leave the homosexual lifestyle. And so that becomes a big part of the agenda that's out there.
Absolutely. They can't abide it because of the implications are too great for them. But obviously, you see people with a radical change of heart. Now, it's always some self-serving argument. For example, they never were gay. That's one we hear all the time. Or hey, John, you know, I could practice to write left-handed. Mm-hmm. If I start right now, in 5 years, I could probably be pretty good at writing things left-handed. These are all the sorts of self-serving analogies, but they won't. It's interesting, Rena. You're right. They really are coming to the point where they're denying almost the right, you know, with the legislation. Talk about that a little bit. The legislation in California, which would make it illegal to take, for example, your son. If your son came home and said, Dad, I'm gay, it would make it illegal to take him to a so-called reparative therapy counseling place to deal with maybe the root causes that I believe homosexuality is often a learned behavior. It's going to make it illegal to do that, Rena. So they're really trying to ban the promotion of that.
Yeah, and that's important because that's why the battle in our public schools that we see, and now this bill in California that's taking place there, you know, they target our children. And because, you know, the Bible tells us that it's important to raise our children up to the truth of Scripture. And so, therefore, those who are living a sinful lifestyle also know that if they can convince the youth that this sinful lifestyle is okay and acceptable and normal, it's going to be harder when they become adults to want to change those beliefs and to, you know, act, as they would call it, discriminatory. And so what we see in California is they want to make it illegal for parents to allow their kids to go to doctors to help them resist same-sex attraction. So think about that. What else can't you consent to as a parent for medical treatment? I mean, you can consent to all sorts of treatment. But here, if you are a child, under no circumstances is that state going to allow you to be taken to counseling, even if you don't want to be involved in the same-sex lifestyle.
Right. The same left that makes it illegal for a parent to even know about an abortion, or a child can be taken from a public school to get an abortion without the parent's knowledge, tell me if I'm exaggerating, is now saying you can't even go. You can't even take your child to a so-called reparative therapy center. And let's be clear, both of you, we are not saying that change comes only through reparative therapy. In fact, I'm of the belief, Rena, you probably agree with me, that some of the most successful change you see out of homosexuality comes through a relationship with Jesus Christ. People who are radically changed. I was radically changed. I got born again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of the Christian doctrine, born again, regeneration through Christ. There are lots of people who don't even go to reparative therapy who've left that lifestyle. Rena, here's the question I have for you. And John, I want you to comment as well. The law, according to a biblical, and I believe our founding fathers too, the law was meant to dissuade people from practicing sin. Now it's flipped. How important is that? I mean, isn't that the core purpose of the law, Rena?
That's exactly it. And when you look at these decisions, they have flipped it. And so even the most recent Defense of Marriage Act case that took place, you know, in the First Circuit, that dealt exactly with that. So that what they say is, you know, unless you have some other reason other than it's morally wrong and it's bad conduct, the law's not going to stand up. Well, that's what the law is about. It's making moral decisions all the time, and it's society steering people in the direction they want them to go. And what we're seeing the court say is, actually, we're going to flip it on its head. If you're the minority and you're engaged in something that the majority thinks is immoral, well, suddenly we have to give you extra protections to engage in your wrong conduct. And that's the kind of thing we're seeing take place in the courts, to protect the minority's beliefs against the majority's determination that something is wrong and harmful to you, and their attempts to protect you and steer you in the right direction.
And John, you're a pastor. I mean, that's the government, you know, originally was sort of to reaffirm what you teach. I mean, what your purpose is.
Both Romans and Isaiah, both the Apostle Paul and Isaiah say the purpose of government is to reward he that does good and to judge he that does evil. The problem that comes in when Isaiah says, woe unto them who call evil good and good evil. That's two different things. Calling evil good is saying that homosexuality is virtuous. But calling good evil is what they're doing to Chick-fil-A, yeah. Dan Cathy, and the rest of us. These are two things. They go together like two sides of a coin.
Well said. Yes. I mean, let's be clear. It's the goal is vilification. And the means is intimidation, and it goes right back to the beginnings of this movement. Back to when Anita Bryant had a pie slammed in her face at a press conference. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage anybody in the listening audience, just Google Anita Bryant pie in the face. It's instructive. This man with this vicious look on his face slamming a pie in her face. They know that that's when they didn't have the power they have. That was back when they were still pretty much homosexuality was not popular. It's become popular to a lot of people. But now it's a different story. And as their power grows, so goes their ability to vilify and to punish people in a reverse direction from what we were talking about biblically. They're punishing the good people. We're talking to Rena Lindewaltz, and we'll be right back after the break. AmericansForTruth.org. We're back, folks, with our last segment with Professor Rena Lindewaltz. And folks, we actually interviewed Rena before. I did when we were on YLL. So, Rena, thanks for taking all this time. You really are teaching people and getting people to lose some of their old understandings, this political correctness that is built up. John was just saying off air, Rena, that in this environment in which the law is being used to promote immorality, it's going to put pressure on Christians to, you know, those of us who will not buckle, will not celebrate immorality, mm-hmm. there's going to be increasing pressure on Christians to stay strong, isn't there?
I believe so, and I think we have to think about that, and even choices we make already that are minimal about, you know, where we may shop. You know, I certainly make choices in protest of where I won't shop. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to get to a point where, you know, we're going to have to radically change perhaps the way we live and be concerned about our freedoms just because of our religious beliefs.
Well, Rena, let's go. We have the last segment here. Let's get back to what we talked about last interview last week, which is openly homosexual judges. Chicago has a very fascinating case. As in many of the cases across the country, it's a big setup. John, the fix is in Illinois. Not only do we have a homosexual two lawsuits, one brought by the homosexual group, another brought by the ACLU, representing these 25 so-called gay couples that want to get married. They brought the lawsuits. They sued Cook County Clerk David Orr, who's radically pro-homosexual himself. Then Attorney General Lisa Madigan decided she was going to side with the homosexuals rather than defend Illinois' existing marriage law. There was a protection of marriage provision put in Illinois' law defining it as between one man and one woman. Well, the people who are supposed to be defending that law side with the gay activists, and now there are no senior officials, all Democrats, of course, from the Attorney General to other prosecutors, willing to defend our law. And so it's fallen upon Thomas More Law Center, or Thomas More Society in Chicago, Tom Brecka, great, great American, tremendous lawyer. It's fallen on him to defend our marriage law in Illinois. Well, to make matters worse, Rena, we now have, there's a beep going on there, I don't know what that is, but we now have an openly homosexual judge, Sophia Hall, in Chicago who's going to be hearing the case. And we got in a discussion about, can we get justice from an openly homosexual judge? Rena, restate your position on that.
Well, with respect to Judge Hall in particular, you know, I obviously none of us know exactly how she would rule. And what I'm saying is not that she can't rule fairly necessarily in this case, but in her case in particular, you know, the standard is low. If there's even a de minimis, you know, the littlest indication to the public that she could be impacted by this decision positively, which because of her open activities, you know, she could be positively impacted depending on the outcome, you know, there's a perception of bias, and she needs to step down. And so in her case, that's what we're dealing with.
Okay, let me interject there.
Yeah.
Rena, and I should have brought this up just now. She's a member of a group called Alliance of Illinois Judges, which is a pro-homosexual group. A member, there are 13 or 14 openly homosexual judges in Cook County, I believe. She's one of them. This group, when Illinois had its civil union law, you know, all the VIPs, you know, the mayor and everybody in down in Chicago had this big celebration of the civil union's law, and they did civil union ceremonies. This group, Alliance of Illinois Judges, sponsored that event, and they officiated at these so-called civil union commitment ceremonies. So that is, it seems to me, Rena, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't that a highly advocacy activist act for that group? So you could say she's a member of a homosexual advocacy organization.
I mean, she is. I mean, that organization has as its one of its purposes to promote in any way possible, I think the word is any way necessary, to promote LGBT equality as they see it. So it is an activist organization.
Now, Rena, this is going to be a growing controversy, as even some Republicans, such as Virginia's, your governor.
McDonald.
Is it Bob McDonald?
Yep.
Explain what he has done with regard to a case there of an openly homosexual judicial candidate named Tracy Thorne, who was a pro-homosexuals in the military activist before he, you know, got his judicial training. Now he was nominated to become a judge. It was rejected by the Virginia House of Delegates. Now, explain what's happened. He's got in by an appointment, but give us some background there.
Sure. He was the way you're nominated, you're not elected judges here. So he was put up for judicial nomination. He applied for it. The House of Delegates voted not to allow this, and nevertheless, and I'll explain what the governor said. Nevertheless, there's been an interim appointment made, so he is now serving as a judge until the legislature comes back again in January, because we only meet for 6 weeks in Virginia. So he will serve as a judge, it looks like, at least until January.
And what did McDonald say?
McDonald made a statement that, you know, essentially, believes candidates should, for judicial vacancies must be considered based solely on their merit, record, aptitude, and skill, and that no other factor should ever be considered, and he's made clear that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is not acceptable in state government. So he seems to be suggesting it would be inappropriate to consider this judge's open homosexual lifestyle and support of various homosexual causes.
Now, Delegate Bob Marshall in Virginia, who's really a tremendous individual, people across the country need to learn about this guy. Bob Marshall, I used to live in Virginia, so I knew about him. Play the clip of him, John. He fought this appointment.
I know that Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it's been repealed. Obviously, you know, blacks used to have to sit in the back of the bus. They don't have to anymore. There was discrimination. Women couldn't vote. They can vote now. Times have changed. Do you not agree that he could be given a chance?
Dr. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks never took an oath of office that they broke. Sodomy is not a civil right. It's not the same as the civil rights movement. You have to look at the past. And in fact, look, in late 2011, he was critical of the, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He criticized our attorney general simply for explaining what the law of Virginia is with respect to, you know, certain protected classes.
Sir.
So he's gone beyond that. He can be a prosecutor if he wants to, but we don't want advocates as judges.
You bring up sodomy. Is the reason why you voted against him because he's gay, pure and simple?
No, sorry, you're mischaracterizing that. I said sodomy is not a civil right, and there's an effort by homosexual lobbyists to equate the two. That's wrong.
Now, Rena, there's so much to talk about just in this segment, so let's do it for the next 4 minutes. First of all, the CNN reporter, you know, brings up Rosa Parks. It shows where she's coming from. But again, here we have the two views. He's talking about sodomy. She's talking about what John was saying earlier, you know, being gay, the essence of the person. So it really creates a conflict here.
Yeah, and I think we can equate this not only to the judiciary, but the same debate's taken place, you know, who we want to serve as our school teachers, for example. You know, we want moral, upstanding individuals to serve as judges, and this debate's taken place with school teachers, too. But, you know, so if you are engaged in a lifestyle of immorality, whether that be a homosexual lifestyle or adulterous relationship or fornication, you know, that's not the type of moral character that I believe should be someone who's being appointed to become a judge.
And this is going to come up more and more because, John, it's like they're just gay. They're just – you heard the CNN right. reporter. I can't remember her name. Very biased, you know, directly making the comparison with race.
Right. Not only that, but in the Huffington Post article, they say a Virginia Republican delegate. That's who they're talking about here, Bob Marshall. He's a Virginia Republican delegate. And then they go on to say who led the effort to defeat the nomination of a gay Richmond prosecutor.
What?
Yeah. Well, why do you have to throw in gay?
Well, it seems that Reno, yeah. Number one, he's a homosexual. He's a homosexual activist. And he's already demonstrated his clear bias. How could we hope to get a fair ruling on anything related to homosexuality from this individual?
Yeah, and I think just to bring that up, because one of the articles talked about, well, given the appointment that he was given, that you know he wouldn't be dealing with issues that might implicate that. But I think it goes broader than that. I think it goes to fit moral character, and I think that's a necessary qualification of any judicial appointment. And so, therefore, it is relevant based on your conduct to judge and decide whether you should be allowed to sit as in the judiciary.
And it comes back to the problem. It's all semantics. You know, if there was a openly pro swinger heterosexual judicial candidate, I'd be against that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the difference is the homosexual lobby has taken one sin. It's a sin movement that calls itself gay. It's taken one sin and said, this is an identity. We've redefined it. And how dare you, public, even Christians, you can't go by any other understanding than our understanding. And you could hear that from the CNN reporter. She was, you know, you could hear her shock when he started talking about sodomy. Mm-hmm. But at its essence, homosexual advocacy is the promotion of an immoral behavior. And Rena, I mean, this is going to come up again and again. There was even a controversy over this with Focus on the Family. Gary Glenn, who's a pro-family activist in Michigan, and I got involved. We cannot say, it seems to me it's problematic for Christians to say that we could support a gay judge. Because when you say that, when somebody openly identifies as gay, the more open they are in identifying it, the more of an activist mentality they have. Is that fair?
I think the more solidified you are in your belief, and therefore, yeah, you are going to hold to that and use opportunities to advantage that belief.
Yes. And they're always using opportunities to promote what their version of reality on homosexuality. And really quickly, Sally Ride, another great example. Sally Ride was the first female astronaut. And she had many amazing accomplishments. Unfortunately, she also fell into lesbianism and left her husband that she was married. She ended up living in a lesbian lifestyle. She was not public about it. Now, gay activists like Michelangelo Signorelli are using her homosexual, you know, the fact that she practiced a homosexual lifestyle to say, hey, this is another gay hero.
She was a female astronaut. Now she's the lesbian
astronaut. Now she's the lesbian astronaut. And you better believe in textbooks like in California where they're teaching gay history now, there's going to be Sally Ride. So people are going to learn Sally Ride as a, and we're going a bit over here, they're going to learn Sally Ride, Rena, as a gay hero, even though she wasn't even public about it in her life.
Yeah, because they need to contort our history to show that we've accepted this all along, and that it's perfectly normal, and see, you too can do this and become great things. And you can accomplish things, but that's not who she was. It doesn't define who she was and what she accomplished.
And Rena, I tweeted, and this I knew this was going to get me in trouble, but I tweeted, did she have a drinking problem too? And in my tweet, I said that she made great accomplishments, but she should not be, and I didn't, of course she doesn't, I don't know if she had a drinking problem or not, but my point was, the fact that she practiced homosexuality would be about as relevant as saying, Sally Ride, hey, people who drink can be great. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still immoral behavior. It's very sad to me that she was involved in that lifestyle. the fact that she was involved with that lifestyle doesn't take away from the great accomplishments that she had. But the point is, gay identity politics now wants to seize her as a hero, even though obviously she was private about it. It wasn't what she wanted to be known for. And this all goes back to that gay identity thing, which it seems to me is the centrality. And in the law arena, in the way most kids are going to be taught law, most young people will be taught that gay identity is the essence of this issue.
They are going to teach that because these are going to be our future leaders and lawmakers. And if they can convince them of this, then you're going to be able to convince them that it's wrong to discriminate. And from a Christian perspective, we have to come to grips in the church and realize that sin is sin, and we don't have the right to call it anything else. And we don't support laws or, you know, labels that condone immoral conduct.
And Rena, I know there's not a uncompassionate bone in your body. We warn people about sin because we love God. That's what it comes down to. That's how many people come to Christ, because they have to come to grips with the sin in their own life and the understanding that I'm going to pay a price one day if there's not something to cover my sin.
Yeah, if this were any other sin, you wouldn't allow someone to continue down that path if you were a friend and not warn them of that and give them a way out. And this is the one that suddenly they're saying it's wrong to do that. No, we're offering them a lifeline, hope for the future. And they're telling us that we shouldn't be allowed to do that.
Okay, Rena, we've gone over here, but I want you to give a 30-second commercial for parents and potential students who would like to learn the law as you are going to teach it at Liberty.
Liberty University School of Law, we understand that there is an objective truth, a creator God, and upon which our legal foundation is built. And if you want to learn law from that perspective and from the perspective of understanding what our founders intended and why that radically makes a difference in the kind of nation we have, I believe we're the only way you can learn it.
And Rena, can we really have hope that if thousands and thousands of students return to a more sane and our historic, according to America's roots, understanding of law, that we can actually win the system back?
I think with a proper understanding and a small handful fully devoted to serving God and His truth, coupled with a spiritual revival in this nation, put that together, God can accomplish anything.
Okay, Rena, on that note, we just say goodbye, and thanks for going over with us, and we're just so appreciative of you and how devoted you are to not just teaching the law, but glorifying God in the process and serving the Lord. We appreciate
you. Thank you, and thank you for what you do.
Okay, God bless, Rena.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Americans for Truth Hour with Pete LaBarbera and John Kirkwood. All our interviews are available archived at americansfortruth.org. That's americansfortruth.org. Also, don't forget our banquet coming up Saturday, October 27th at Christian Liberty Academy in Arlington Heights, Illinois, featuring Dr. Judith Reisman. That's Saturday, October 27th. Please return to our website, make a donation, americansfortruth.org. There's a donate button. Donate to our cause. Help us to continue with these interviews. And thanks for listening. God bless.